We'll get started now. So, last time we were looking at properties of the radio link and the channel, and basically in this lecture we'll be using those properties. And we observed that in the absence of any impediments or any external factors, power for a radio signal drops with the distance squared, and that's called free space loss. And then we went on further to observe that in the real world, things are more complicated. In particular, you get the multipath phenomenon, which says that not only will a receiver receive the direct signal from a transmitter, but it will receive additional copies of that signal as well that have bounced off various objects, sort of between the sender and the receiver. Okay, so signals come in on different paths. And this leads to a number of problems. The main one that we looked at was, again, the received power. And we looked at an example for just two paths. And we observed that we could have a power drop of up to the distance now raised to the power of 4. Okay. And that has to do with whether the signals received along the same path are in phase. If they're in phase, they sort of reinforce each other, or potentially they're out of phase. And if they're out of phase, then they interfere with each other. There were additional factors such as delay. Obviously, the two paths are not of the same length, so the signals are sort of offset from each other, and if that delay is sort of significant enough, the effect affects not only sort of the interpretation of a single bit, but you're actually receiving signals relating to two separate bits at the same time. Okay. And we said that this was it's a complex problem. We mentioned a number of empirical models that were developed to try and sort of more accurately represent the actual power drop, such as the Akamura model and the Hata model and the Lee model. But for our purposes, moving forward, we're just going to assume that our power drops as some factor of the distance from transmitter to receiver. Okay, so this factor typically is going to be somewhere between 2, so d squared, and up to, say, 5.5. And we're not going to, from now on, concern ourselves with exactly what that factor is. Okay. We further observed that mobility complicated our picture even further. When you combine it with multipath, you get fading. And what this means is certain frequencies within the spectrum are going to be more adversely affected than others. And we saw there were a number of effects, from fairly gross, such as you're moving, the obstacles change. You know, if you're on one side of a mountain or you're on the other, to very fine, as you move through the wavelengths, again, the phase differential shifts quite rapidly, and that causes dropping out at certain frequencies. We concluded by just observing that in order to counteract these effects in mobile systems, spread spectrum techniques are frequently used. So if you have this fading in sort of certain frequency ranges, if your signal's concentrated in that range, you're in trouble. What you would like instead is to have spread your signal over a wider range. So you'll have sort of portions of it taken out, but not the whole thing. So hopefully, if you have enough left, you can reconstruct. Okay. And so that led on to our second topic, spread spectrum, which is a different modulation technique which combats fading by spreading the signal over a wider frequency range. And yeah, there's obviously no real, I mean, that could be done quite easily, but in particular, we have this issue that our bandwidth is at a premium in wireless systems. We can only use a certain frequency range. And so if we want to broaden out the amount of spectrum that any single signal is using, then what we really need to do is find a way to share that spectrum amongst multiple users. And so we looked at two techniques for doing that: frequency hopping, spread spectrum. So you divided your spectrum into frequency bands. The modulation would occur sort of within a band, and then you'd hop from band to band. And then direct sequence spread spectrum, where you would essentially encode each bit as a number of different bits using a chipping code, and as you increase the bit rate, you spread your spectrum. Okay. And we looked at a few methods of choosing your spreading codes, and we observed that ideally these should lead to orthogonal codes. Again, the way that we can share our spectrum is by choosing codes that don't interfere with each other. And again, if you're looking at frequency hopping, you just, the different signals would be in different frequency bands at the same time. If you're looking at direct sequence spread spectrum, we saw that if we chose the codes cleverly, you could recover individual signals. Okay. And so in order to perfectly recover the signal, the code needs to be what's called orthogonal. And additionally, it should be noise-like, so that has to do with being able to spread the spectrum. So I left you last time with a problem dealing with spread spectrum. And so we have a spread spectrum system, and we have our input data is a sequence of bits. Then we have a PN code, and we see that this changes every 4 bits, and there are 3 bits, sorry, sort of every 4 time units, I should say. And then based on some hopping policy, you get the following frequencies. So F1, F3, F23, F22, F8, etc. Okay, so then we just ask a sequence of questions about this system. And the first of those is, what is the period of the PN sequence? And the period is, 15 bits. Okay, and so every 15 bits, our sequence, every 15 bits as encoded in the PN, our sequence resets itself. How do we know that? Well, basically we know it because that was part of the original problem statement, just said that this was a complete cycle for our PN sequence. Okay, so it's 15 bits long. Okay, so what form of frequency shift keying is used? And the form of frequency shift keying used here is a 4-bit representation, which means that per signaling element, you have a 2-bit, represent 2 bits per signaling element. Okay. Now you might ask, well, how can you see that? And basically just think about how the problem is structured. And if you had 1 bit per signaling element, well, you would have to change frequencies too often. And if you had more than that, what you would see is that you would need a greater, if you say had 3 bits per signaling element, you'd see that you would need a greater frequency range than is provided. Okay. Okay, so if you have 4 levels, that's 2 or 4 frequencies, that allows you to represent 2 bits, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. You need 4 frequencies to do that. Okay, and we also see just from the way the problem is structured that we have 3 PN bits per hop. Okay. And again, that's just clear from the way the frequencies are changing in conjunction to the way the data bits are changing. Okay. And so is this slow or fast? Well, this is slow because you're having 2 symbols, so 2 frequency changes per hop. So the hop is happening every 4 time units, and within that you have 2 changes for the modulation scheme, from 0, 1 to 1, 1 in the first case. And the final question is, what is the total number of possible hops? And so now I have to ask, did anybody see anything a little bit strange about this problem? In particular, in the first frequency, the frequency F1 there. Well, I'll tell you. What happens is our first range is 00, represented by 001. And this 001 plus the bits 01 give us a frequency of F1. What this indicates is if you think of your frequencies going from F0 onwards, what this indicates is that our PN code 000 is not being used. Okay. So, there's two possible answers to this problem. The first thing you might observe is that our PN code is 3 bits long. So that will, if you think about 00 to 111, that gives you 8 hop frequencies. You combine that with 4 individual frequencies for the modulation, for the frequency shift keying to represent 2 bits, and that gives you 8 times 4. Total frequencies or hops possible. Now, as I said, in this problem, actually, the PN sequence 000 doesn't exist. So you actually only have 7 ranges possible, and 4 times 7 then would give you 28. Can anybody speculate on why 000 might not exist? Okay, well, one reason possibly is how the PN sequence is generated. If you're using linear shift registers, for instance, and you're getting out 3 bits per, then you don't want the combination 000. You can't start with it because it would just keep generating zeros. And similarly, if you don't start with it, then you'll never get it. So one possible reason that it might not have appeared as a code is that, again, has to do with how it might be generated. Okay, so does anybody have any questions about that? Okay. If not, we'll move on to today's topic. Where am I? Oh, come on. Okay, sorry, just wasn't sure what Camtasia was doing there. We seem to still be recording, so I'll just go on from there. So, today we're going to start looking at cellular networks and the basic design principles behind cellular networks. So right now what we have is something very basic. We have a way of making a point-to-point connection between a sender and a receiver. And somehow we need to change that very low-level connection into a way that we can make telephone calls while we're driving along, while we're moving. And so, again, we're going to need to somehow turn a point-to-point connection of limited range into complete blanket coverage of an area, and coverage that somehow ensures connectivity even while you're moving. Okay, so the primary source for this, again, is Stallings. A bit of the sort of geometric manipulations that we'll see later is not there, but I think they're straightforward enough, and Black, etc., would have that aspect. Okay. William Lee is good for how things are done in practice. Again, 2006 is a pretty long way away for this sort of work, but still, some of the sort of optimization techniques for how you get sort of more out of your channels are still done, and still, you know, they're discussed in Lee. Okay, so what are we going to look at today? Well, we're going to start with just a basic overview of how the connectivity works, and sort of, again, how do we provide sort of for now a voice call under these circumstances where you could be anywhere and you could be moving. Okay. We'll look at how we set up such a system. And we'll see that the core of this is, again, how you're providing that sort of blanket coverage. And we'll look at sort of the details of that in simplified cellular design. Then we'll talk about power control. So the issue with cellular design is to try and minimize interference between one connection and another. And so a certain level of that is done just in how you design your system, but an additional amount needs to be done just to control the levels of power between your mobile and your access point or your base station. We'll then look at traffic engineering at a sort of a very high level for you, for the master's students. You would have seen sort of more complex analysis of similar types of systems in, well, actually you wouldn't. Last year's problem was a cellular problem. But we'll look at some sort of very basic results for how many users can be supported within a cellular system. And finally, we'll wrap up. We've done this analysis for a very simple, basic type of cellular network, and we'll look at what tricks can be used to increase the capacity from that sort of very basic design. Okay. So, the goal of our networks, again, is to get large-scale coverage, allow the users mobility so they can move through the network while maintaining connectivity, have low power consumption, and sort of obviously these days that's that's a hot topic for everybody, sort of how do you reduce energy consumption in all facets of life. But it has always been an issue for cellular systems, for the end device. The higher the power you're required to transmit at, the faster your battery is going to wear down. So you want to transmit at the lowest power possible. And we're going to have some scheme for reusing our frequency spectrum. Okay. So the basic idea is that we have a limited number of channels available. You can split your spectrum into a certain number of channels and no more. But if you have a transmitter and a receiver, their signals are going to have a limited range. So again, free space law says they decline as distance squared. Our general result says they decline as some power of the distance. So this means that if you have called channel frequency, you're sending a signal on a certain frequency. If you've got another transmitter and receiver, if they're far enough away, they can use the same frequency. And there'll be sort of minimal interference between the two connections, assuming again that they're far enough apart. So this has led to a cellular structure for our networks, where a cell is served by a base station. So this gives access from your mobile phone into the main network. And you can think of it as a big antenna, so it's sending and receiving signals. And the then there's going to be a limited range at which the base station can send and receive these signals. Okay. So if we put enough base stations down, then you'll hopefully always be within range of at least one base station. And then there is a question of what channels do you use within the range of the base station? And the simple rule we want is that we don't want the same channels used in two adjacent cells or in cells that are close enough together to interfere with each other. Okay. Now, what we're going to look at initially is very regular patterns where the base stations are equidistant from each other, leading to same size cells and same power levels, etc. Later on, again, we'll discuss what happens if that isn't the case. In reality, again, where base stations are placed depends on terrain, it depends on planning issues, there's a load of things, so it's unlikely that actually you'll get this regularity in reality. Okay, but for the purposes of analysis, we're going to assume we have it. And so that leads to how we provide basic coverage. So there will always be some channel available, assuming it's not busy. And the second sort of issue that arises then is mobility. So it's one thing to say that you're stationary and you have a connection, you have total coverage, so you have a connection into the network wherever you are. But now you're moving, which means that the connection that you have might not last. You've got a good connection with a base station, then you move away from that base station, and obviously the connection deteriorates. And so, if you have complete coverage, there should be another base station that when the connection is too bad to the one, you should be able to connect to another. But you have to do this in a smooth fashion. Okay, so again, what we get, at least in theory, is a network that looks quite regular. We have our base stations set out at uniform distances from each other. The range of the base station is circular, ideally. Obviously, since it's adjacent to another base station, you have, the circles will overlap at the edges, so we just sort of divide it in the middle here. The base stations will provide us connectivity into a fixed network, a wired network. They'll do this through a mobile switching center. You'll see how it comes into play in a minute. And finally, again, we have to share our total range of available channels between different base stations, okay, and using this rule that at least adjacent base stations should use different channel sets. So in this example, we have 7 different channel sets, so each of these sets would have a completely different frequency range, and so we assign the base stations one of these channel sets, and we try and keep identical channel sets as far apart as possible, so far, as far away from interference as possible. Okay, so the issues that are going to arise with this sort of setup are frequency reuse. How are we going to make these channel set assignments in a sort of optimal fashion, which is going to be a factor of, well, basically, where you put your base stations, and then power characteristics, specifically in the form of the signal-to-noise ratio. Okay. And here, a component of the noise, the only component of noise, actually, that we're going to consider is interference. So interference from other portions of the system using the same channels. Okay. And again, another issue is power management. So we need to overcome noise, but we want to limit the amount of interference that we're causing, and we also want to preserve the battery life of our phone, which, you know, from now on we're going to call our mobile unit. Okay. So we have the sort of two competing factors of overcoming noise and then trying to keep it, once you've done that, trying to keep it as low as the power as low as possible. Okay. And so what we'll do is we'll look, we're going to spend a fair amount of time looking at this frequency reuse problem. We'll mention power management strategies. And then once we have the sort of basic setup, then we'll look at exactly how many customers can we accommodate in the system. Okay, and finally, again, we'll wrap up by looking at sort of how can we have this basic model, how can we improve on that basic model? Okay, so before we start with the cellular design, we'll just, again, just to fix in our minds exactly what's going on, we'll have a look at the operations of a cellular network. So exactly how are these calls being set up and managed? Okay. So, again, the idea is that we have our phone or our mobile unit, and this will connect into the system via a base station. Okay, so that's the first step in the connection to a greater network. And so you have your mobile unit. It needs to link to these base stations. So they're essentially just an access point. And these base stations are then connected to a mobile switching center, which will link into the public telephone network or the mobile network. So typically you will have a number of base stations which all link into one MSC or MTSO. And those terms will be used sort of equivalently here. Okay. So, what happens if I want to make a call? And we'll assume I'm calling another mobile just to sort of, again, catch as many features as possible. Well, the first thing I have to do is make a connection to the network myself. And this means that I have to choose which base station to communicate with. And I can do that by monitoring and for the strongest signal. Then I can request a connection to a base station. Through the base station, I can request a connection to some other number, some other mobile unit. That mobile unit has to be found, so the MTSO will perform paging to find where the mobile unit, where the sort of callee is located. When the callee is located, then they can accept the call through their base station, and then that call can occur. The additional factor that possibly can happen then, that picture doesn't really show it, so I don't, is that Oh, okay, down here, yeah. That these stations are moving, and so you can have movement from one, from the range of one base station to another, and at that point, handover has to occur. Okay. So, again, the first step was the mobile unit initialization. So, the caller has to connect up with a base station, and the way it does this is that the base stations are broadcasting control signals. The mobile unit will scan for the strongest signal, and then it will do some sort of handshaking procedure to connect up with not just the base station, but the MPSO or MSC, so that base station is connected to. And the purpose for that is that the user is then identified and the user location is registered. So we can now find that user. Okay. Once our caller is connected to the network, the next step is to take the phone number information and request a setup over a setup channel. And they have to wait for that channel to be idle. Again, it'll be the specific signal channel on which you do this. And once that request is made, that's forwarded to the MTSO. So the MTSO essentially now has this number which it associates with a specific callee. Now, the MTSO doesn't know exactly where the callee is, so it pages a number of base stations. It would know, it should know roughly where it is, but not down to the base station level. So it asks a number of base stations for what the destination of the callee is now. Okay. So, when the callee is located, the callee will get a ringing tone, and if it accepts the call, then it will be communicated with on the setup channel. When it accepts the call, it indicates that to the base station, which forwards that information on to the MTSO. And then the MTSO sets up a circuit. So a dedicated channel between the two base stations, selects channels for the base stations to connect to the mobile units, and then notifies the base stations, which in turn notify the mobile units. Okay. And so then, that circuit is maintained until one of the mobile units moves out of range of their base station, and in that case, a new base station and a new channel have to be found. Okay, so one point that I'll make about this is that, again, I think it's a good sort of basic example to keep in mind, but it's referring to setting up a circuit switch, so setting up a dedicated channel between sender and receiver. And so again, you've got the idea of you have channels along which senders and receivers are connected, and then channels along which control information, so communications between essentially the network and a sender or a receiver occur. Now, things get a little more complicated, and again, modern systems where not everything is geared towards voice connectivity, but still it's a good picture to have in mind. Okay, so now handover can possibly occur, and the end result of handover is that our mobile unit changes from being connected to one base station on some channel to being connected to a different base station on a different channel. Okay. And the question is, how is this decision made as to when to hand over? And this decision can either be made by the base station alone, so it can monitor the strength of the mobile unit's signal, and when it gets weak enough, it'll again notify the MTSO, who will notify another base station or instruct the mobile unit to change to another base station. Or possibly this can happen with feedback from the mobile unit. And so basically, you want to, at the simplest level, what you want to do is to connect to the base station with which you've got the strongest connectivity. Now, there are factors which make it not quite that simple. One factor is cell congestion. So it might be that you're moving away from your base station towards another base station, but within the cell, governed by the second base station, there's already a lot of users. Maybe there's not a channel free, or let's just assume there's not a channel free. So if you were to try to make the switch, then your call could potentially be dropped. Okay. In this case, it's probably worth trying to delay changing, or maintain your connection with your original base station and hope that, well, either you change directions and start moving towards a more useful base station, or with time, you know, again, the usage of the base stations can change. Okay. Even assuming that the cells are not particularly congested, there are still issues with taking a very simplistic view of taking the strongest signal possible. And so this mainly has to do, again, with how exactly you're traveling through, where the base stations are relative to where you're traveling. So you can think of sort of the ideal case is you've got these two base stations here and you're moving directly from one to another. That's easy. Okay. So as you move from one to another, obviously you're going to the strength of one connection is going to weaken the strength of another connection would increase. So at some point, as you move, you'd want to switch from one to the other. Potentially, that's not the direction you're moving. You could be moving along the boundary between two base stations. And in this case, sort of in this region where you're at the boundary, that it's not nearly as clear which base station you should be connected to. What can happen is that there can be changes in sort of which is stronger, which is weaker.
Yeah.
That are sort of relatively minor, but if you take your simple policy of sort of strongest signal, you can bounce between the two base stations, which is not necessarily desirable. Okay. So a number of policies are proposed to try and counteract that sort of effect. So you can take the strongest signal plus threshold. So only change if your signal strength on your current connection drops below a certain threshold and the other signal is stronger. Another policy is strongest signal with hysteresis. And here you change if the new signal is stronger by a certain amount. So the assumption is if you're on this boundary, the signals are going to be roughly equal, so don't change. If you move far enough away from the boundary, then one signal should be clearly stronger than the other. And in that case, change. Okay. And finally, you can try and use predictive techniques where you try and decide whether your current connection is strengthening or weakening. And so if it's staying the same or strengthening, then you want to keep with it. If it looks like it's weakening, then you want to look around and change. Okay, so that's a very high-level overview of sort of how connectivity is provided in cellular systems. Our next topic is cellular design. And so what we're going to look at here is how we lay out our cells, and furthermore, how do we assign channels to the cells so that we can get to a specific signal interference ratio. Okay, now since we've been going about an hour already, I think I'll call a break here, since, again, this is a funny topic. It's a lot of it's just sort of simple geometry, but there are sort of a few ins and outs, so let's have a little break here and come back and sort of address it with clear heads.